make sure you're in fellowship and continue on here. Let's get the exegesis of this out of the way here, dealing with verse 28. And by the way, you should probably know, if you didn't pick up on it, that this is the first time Jesus specifically tells them to focus on something through this. Everything else has been fairly general, and even when it's specific, he didn't necessarily tell them to learn it. Here, this command, monthano, to learn something, indicates that this is in some way critical to the answer to their question. So learn the parable from the fig tree. Well, what is the acted out parable of the fig tree teaching? Well, it was teaching, as we know from the previous context, about the destruction of the temple. What would a rebirthed, as it were, a renewed fig tree mean? Well, it would point to a new temple, and that's pretty simple. So when its branch has already become tender, is actually the conjunction hatan, which makes, it's a particle in contingency or a conjunction of contingency, and it makes what follows indefinite. So when or whenever, whenever already is the adverb ade, already the branch. This is klados, K-L-A-D-O-S, which means exactly that, branches on trees, of any type of tree. When the branch of it has already become tender, already actually kind of goes that a-day, now goes with this verb, hapalos, H-A-P-A-L-O-S. It's only used two times. It means that which yields readily to pressure, tender as opposed to hard or tough. So when it has become... Genomai is the verb, to become. And then, and by the way, when you see genomai, it's important because they have a to be verb, where the Hebrew language does not. The Greek word, the Greek language has a to be verb, and it has a to become verb. This means be, this means become. This one always signifies a change in status. This one is, essentially, we might say, is used to, equal to our equal signs. That's what aimi means, is. But when the branch has become tender, already having become, aorist deponent subjunctive, and puts forth its leaves, is ekphuo, the verb, E-K-P-H-U-O, E-K rather, P-H-U-O. Twice this is only used to produce something or generate something, hence to grow. And then you have this accusative neuter plural, its leaves, the definite article, to, with phulon, P-H-U-L-L-O-N. Six times that word used. I mean, a single, it means a leaf. Leaves, plural, or collectively, sometimes it's even just translated as foliage. Recognize, know, or understand. This is the verb, not the simple verb, oida, to know. This is gnosko, and this involves knowledge that one gains by some process or by doing something. Oida just means you know it, okay? How did you find it out? Well, you could have found it out any number of ways. It doesn't matter how you know it, but gnosko deals with that which you have to think about, which you have to figure out, which you have to put together, or which circumstances make plain to you, obviously. That's another way we learn. So our circumstances make things plain. Recognize that. Hadi here introduces the content of what they're supposed to recognize. And you've got a present active indicative here. You recognize that summer is near. The word ingus is the E-N-G-U-S. Actually, it's E-G-G in the Hebrew, or in the Greek, but rules of phonetics, you pronounce it ingus. The adverb is coming or is near, and then to theros, T-H-E-R-O-S. And in this context, it means the warm. It's only used three times, by the way. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all use it to refer to this. The warm growing season or summer. When you see these things start to happen, you know that summer is near. Okay, well, that's pretty standard stuff. We see trees start to bud, we see the flowers start to bloom, and we recognize we're in springtime and that summer's not far. Not hard to figure out. I mean, the physical logistics of this aren't hard to see. Even so, though, now he's going to, with this even so, in like fashion, now that we know the physical realities we're talking about, and he's going to tell them, now there's some spiritual realities that back this up. This is the answer to your question. When's the end of the age going to be? How are we going to know that it's near? Even so, you too, when you see these things happening, recognize that it, i.e. the end of the age, is near, right at the door. And you have this adverb here, huto, in a like manner, or even so. So also, or even you too, you also, when you see these things happening, when or whenever, is again, hatan, this indefinite conjunction. You see, as Idon, the aorist of horao, the verb to see, these things. Whenever you see these things, recognize, or coming to pass, rather. When you see these things, they've translated happening, you've got ginomai again, G-I-N-O-M-A-I. And this means becoming, coming to pass, they've translated it here as happening. Recognize or figure out, recognize that it is nearby. But he doesn't say what it is. In the previous context, it's pretty easy. He's talking about summer. Well, what is he talking about here? Well, he's talking about the end of the age. Recognize that the end of the age is coming upon you. That this is how you're going to know. And so I put in there for my translation with the notes, and this is one of the first things you're supposed to do in first year Greek, is you got to identify your antecedents and your pronouns and all the grammatical relationships that are there. So what is it? Well, the it is an answer to their question, what is the sign of the end of the age? This is your sign. Learn it, know it, understand it. Recognize that, again, Gahadi introduces the content, that nearby it is. Or he is, depending upon if one wants to translate this as a third person. It is a third person singular, but in the Greek, there's no discrete way of doing whether it's an it or a he. In the verb, anyway, there's not. So you could translate this legitimately, he is or it is. And if he is, if you translate in he here, which doesn't do any injustice to it, you're talking about the return of the Lord is near. That he is near, that he is coming. That he is near, epi, upon, at the door. The word thura is door, and it's a plural, dative feminine plural, at the doors. All right, point one, Jesus had just announced the chronology of the last days, or advanced it rather, to the time of his coming and the gathering together of the elect by the angelic host. Two, Matthew's account of the judgment of the sheep and the goats indicates that the wicked and the elect are gathered together before the Lord, with each group receiving the appropriate commendation or condemnation. That we see, and these appear to be, again, the one group taken off the planet, burned off, as it were, the negative. And then the positive, the believers that have survived Daniel's 70th week, then will then move on into the millennial condition. However, that passage presumably focuses on those that have survived the events of Daniel's 70th week and who are still in their earthly bodies. For the gathering of the elect from the farthest reaches of the earth and sky would then appear to be dealing with those that are about to receive their resurrection bodies, and not to those believers that have survived Daniel's 70th week. Well, these about to receive their resurrection body would be prior to the age of Israel, the time of the Gentiles up through the giving of the law at Sinai, and then those who lived during the age of Israel. This last 7 years of Daniel's 70th week, which is technically a part of the age of Israel, that group that survives that doesn't immediately receive their resurrection bodies. Otherwise, there would be no way to repopulate the earth. You've got to have humans, because we know, I mean, if we learned anything in Mark about that deal in marriage and all of that, is that there's no sex in heaven. And that everybody is celibate. So you're not going to repopulate the planet with resurrected believers. It can only be believers in their regular, still earthly bodies. So people like Moses, they will receive their resurrection at this time. The thrones are set up, the first resurrection as it's called, in the book of Revelation. So five, however, with the conclusion of verse 27, it is clear that Jesus is changing subject matter. And in fact, Jesus is now providing the answer to their final question about the sign of the end of the age. And six, this verse is introduced by the mild adversative conjunction, duh, which Jesus has used nine times in this chapter. And each of those other usages refers to future conditions from the standpoint of the hearers at any rate. And the fact that Jesus has provided all the information necessary to identify those conditions and avoid premature expectations. If anything that these prophetic passages point to, it is the necessity for believers not to get anxious, not to get their hopes up too soon. Because what is one of the greatest things that will wreck believers that I've seen is this matter of premature expectations or unrealistic expectations. If you have unrealistic expectations, when things don't live up to that, well, then you're disappointed. And what do we know about disappointment? Hope deferred makes the heart sick. I mean, it literally causes depression and these other factors. Well, how many people have gotten over the centuries, have become disenfranchised and disenchanted with Christianity because of date setters? A whole bunch of them. Millions of them have gotten disenchanted because what happens? These people are always wrong. To this point, every one of them has been 100% wrong. All of them. And then they're still idiots still doing it today. Now go figure. Well, if we've learned one thing from history, it's that we don't learn anything from history. That's the problem. So we have this revisionist history that people adopt. Well, the point is, this is what has gotten people off their spiritual feed because they're looking for the wrong things. And sadly, to identify Israel as the fig tree, national Israel, has also caused this at some level. Because I don't know about anybody else, but I always had trouble with the fact that we have to just keep stretching a generation on and on and on and on because it never seems to end. It still hasn't ended yet. I mean, we're at 65 years and counting from 1948. And so, what are we going to do in another 10 years when it's 75 years from that? How are we going to claim that's within a generation? Well, the longer this stretches out, the more problematic that interpretation becomes. That the fig tree is national Israel. And by the way, when I went in and did the work on this, first, number one, I have to tell you, I was stunned. When I first came across this, I did not want to believe what I was seeing here. Because I, much like everybody else, had bought this doctrine hook, line, and sinker, and had swallowed it and taught it repeatedly. So I'm faced with now, okay, either I've got to renege and get this egg off of my face here, or else I can just cover it up and move on. Well, I'm not one of the covered up, moving on types. As painful as it was to look at, and I suspected there would be some fallout from other pastors about this, and there has been some. Nothing major, but the point is, nobody wants to hear this at some level. And that's sad, because you have to be willing to think outside the box and ask yourself, you know, is our theological grid sound? And if it's not, then we've got to look at it and be willing to intellectually, honestly evaluate it, or else we're never going to grow beyond what we are now. This is impossible. So when I looked at this, one of the things that stands out in this whole chapter is, again, this idea of premature expectations. And then when I looked at the documentation for the fig tree, I went, oh boy, that is thin. In fact, there is really only one verse you can point to in the entire Old Testament that suggests that the fig tree is national Israel. And even that verse, and we're going to look at it because we're going to cover all the bases here. And even that verse is problematic. It doesn't definitively prove it. And so for a quote, the doctrine of movement, which is supposed to pride itself on intellectual honesty and evaluating information before we pass judgment on it. I just find that too many people out there are just parroting what they've already heard. They don't think outside the box. If one pastor taught it, the bishop in Houston, then everybody else must go along. Well, there is no bishop in Houston, people. There's none in Oklahoma City or anywhere else or Sarasota or anywhere. We have to do our own work. And so people get these premature expectations. I would like this to be over. I don't know about you. I'm anxious to get to heaven. You say, well, I've got stuff I want to do. Well, good for you. I don't. I've pretty much done everything I wanted. I could leave the rest of this world behind and go to heaven. It would be fine. Wouldn't bother me. But if you get people psyched up about this too soon, And, you know, using a sporting analogy, it's called getting your team to peak at the wrong time. You don't want your team peaking until the right time. And you don't want to get them too psyched up. And I've watched, you know, and probably everybody here who's ever watched any sporting event or knows or follows them much, basketball, baseball, football particularly, is that basketball and football, teams will come out and they'll get all emotionally charged up. The coach will give them the big pregame speech in the locker room. Let's win one for the Gipper. And, you know, rah, 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 and sis boom, bah, and all that. And then the team goes out and they're all psyched up. And guess what? After about a quarter of football, they fall flat. Why? Because they were emotionally too charged up about something that was going to require more than 15 minutes of play. They got to play a whole hour. And so as believers, people have gotten all psyched up about this. Well, then when it hasn't come true, people are becoming disenfranchised and disenchanted by it. Why? Well, maybe then the reason it's not coming true is because our doctrine had a fundamental flaw in the first place, which I believe it did. And I think Mark, had I not done Mark, I'm absolutely sure I would not have found this. I mean, there's no secret in my thinking anyway that Mark is the one that makes this the plainest. So he tells him, don't get too psyched up. Verse 7, don't be frightened. Verse 13, you will be hated. But the one who endures to the end, he will be saved. And then verse 14. When you see this, then flee. It's not, don't get psyched up and run just the second you think something. It's wait till you see this. And additionally, he uses it to continually here emphasize the need for remaining alert and for not being deceived by frauds and imposters. Verse 5, see to it that no one misleads you. Verse 9, be on your guard. Verse 23, take heed. I have told you everything in advance. So 9, however, this use of the conjunction here is clearly indicating a change in subject matter. Since this is the first time Jesus challenges the apostles to learn something, he essentially makes what he's saying here about the fig tree the whole focal point of this entire discourse. Why? Well, it's important because it does answer the question, where is the sign at the end of the age? How are we going to know? Well, 10, the Greek construction places the emphasis on the fig tree, with the prepositional phrase beginning the sentence and coming before the main verb or object. In the Greek, actually, you actually just have but or now, the conjunction duh, from the fig tree begins the actual Greek sentence, which is definitely not normal Greek word order. So he's clearly drawing your attention to the fig tree. And the definite article indicates that he has a specific fig tree in view. But again, I like everyone else, looked at this and said, oh yeah, okay, it's national Israel. And then when I went and looked, I thought, well, wait a minute, Mark's only used fig tree 3 other times. And every one of them was in that deal in conjunction with the temple. So that started to get my thinking wondering, uh-oh. Is this not what we have taught it? So you're going to have to look at it. We'll look at all the information. You evaluate it and hear it out first, of course. That's the big deal. Intellectually, honestly, hear it out. So here in verse 12, well, actually, okay, and as will be evident here, the emphasis on the fig tree is very appropriate. And the use of the definite article is significant as well. 12, he continues with the aorist imperative of the verb monthano, to learn, which means to gain knowledge or skill by means of instruction. To learn something from someone that is teaching. In this case, he's the teacher. They're the students. Learn from him. In our case, now I'm the teacher, you're the students. You have to learn from me if you're going to learn. That's the deal. 13, when it is followed by the preposition apo with the ablative, as it is here, that phrase denotes the one doing the teaching. So 14, in this case, the fig tree is the teacher. Obviously, Jesus is the human teacher, but in terms of the big sort of parabolic view of it, the fig tree actually becomes the teacher. But the question arises as to why Jesus is telling them to learn one specific thing. Unless that one thing is the answer to their question about the sign that the end of the age, or that the age was about to end. Well, 15, even those interpreters, France among others, who apply all this to the destruction of the temple, have acknowledged that this introduces Jesus' answer to their request for the sign of the end of the age. Even though he totally botches The interpretation of all this, he gets this verse right. He recognizes what Jesus, what he's doing here. He figured that part out. And that's what I tell you. I mean, you've got such a hodgepodge. We walk a fine line as pastors. I can't tell you don't ever listen to anybody else. But I can tell you that there's such a hodgepodge out there that you'll be literally reading a thing and a guy will do half the verse right and half the verse wrong. And if you don't know or pick up on that, you're in trouble. Then you start to buy into what he's done wrong. Well, we've never been advocates of a plurality of teachers anyway. Because effectively, as we believe, you can only really follow one drummer at anything in life. So again, even though he interprets this whole thing wrongly, he even acknowledges this is what Jesus is giving them as the answer to that question. He gets that. Now, how he applies it to 70 AD is just another mind-boggling thing, but he does somehow. Well, 16, prior to this point, the term fig tree had only been used three times in Mark, and all refer to the fig tree that Jesus cursed on Tuesday morning. And 17, when one recognizes that all the events from Mark 11:20 through 13:37, now this is where, again, if you're not keeping track of the chronology, you'd miss this, that these all occurred on Wednesday. That Wednesday morning was the very morning that they saw the fig tree had withered. And then by Wednesday night on the Mount of Olives, he tells them, now learn from the fig tree. He can be referencing no other fig tree. There's just no other way he could be referencing another fig tree. And there's other tips in the Greek here as well. So the definite article with the noun suke, fig tree, should be understood as used anaphorically. This is the part I know you don't care about. But I don't care. I'm going to tell you anyway. Because it's critical to the interpretation. If it weren't, I'd leave it out. But it's critical. This term is derived from a Greek word that means to bring up again. It's anaphero, which means to bear or carry. And then ana can mean again or up. So it means to bring something up again. The first mention of the subject, the fig tree, is usually anarthrous. That is, without the article. But subsequent references have the article, which is used to direct the reader back to the original subject. And 19, this is precisely what we find in Mark's account. The first use of the fig tree was anarthrous, no article. With the following three usages have the definite article, indicating that the same fig tree is still in view. So Mark 11:13 is where we're first introduced to the fig tree. And that is, again, on Tuesday morning, as they're going into Jerusalem. Mark 11:13, and you even see it rendered in the New American Standard. And seeing at a distance a fig tree. Not the fig tree, a fig tree. And that's the fig tree that we're going to talk about from then on out. And then the way he makes sure you know he's talking about the same fig tree is he uses the definite article with it to point you back to it. So you knew. And then verse 20, as they were walking by in the morning, they saw the fig tree. First one, anarthrous, a fig tree. This one, the fig tree. Clearly the same fig tree. If it's not the same fig tree, this is ludicrous. I mean, this means nothing if it's not the same fig tree. Has to be the same fig tree. And then verse 21, Peter said to him, Rabbi, look, the fig tree which you cursed has withered. It's clearly the same fig tree. And then when you see it in our passage, he says, learn from the fig tree. It has to be the same fig tree that he's just been talking about earlier that day. So thus, here, the exegetical emphasis is that Jesus Christ is still referring to the same fig tree the disciples had observed that morning. Additionally, if they took the same route out of Jerusalem every evening, and it appears they would have, there's no indication that they ever took a different route because there was really only one. They would have gone out the eastern gate, gone down through the Valley of Kidron across, gone up over the Mount of Olives, because we know they were staying on Bethany, which is on the east side of the Mount of Olives. So they had to go up, down, and out, go up over the mountain, and then they'd arrive back in Bethany. Bethany was about 2 miles away from Jerusalem. So it wasn't a long trip. I mean, if you were in a big hurry, you could probably make that trip in, 20 minutes? I mean, if you wanted to walk at a pretty good clip, you can make it probably, you can walk a 10-12 minute mile if you really get after it. So even if you were walking at a normal pace, you'd make the trip in 40 minutes. Not like it's a long time. So it's a pretty close trip. But they were doing this every evening. They would go out of the city. Why? Because Jesus knew if he stayed in the city, they were going to arrest him. And he knew that all this had to come together in God's timing. And he knew God's timing was Thursday night for the arrest. And so he can't rush this up, and nor can he allow them to rush it up. So one of the things you see in all of this is Jesus exhibits his mastery over every one of these details. He stays outside the city, and the first night he comes in and is not outside the city, after dark they arrest him. So he was right about all that. He knew what would happen, and he avoided it. So the exegetical emphasis here is they had likely just passed the... Matter of fact, presuming that they're still... And they are... They've got to be on the west side of the Mount of Olives because he's looking down at the temple. He's looking down at the city. So it's very distinctly possible that that fig tree is right there in front of them. We don't know. We just know it was a lone fig tree beside the road. We're not told specifically where it was, only that it was on the way into the city. So they'd have to pass it on the morning going in, and they'd have to pass it on the evening going out. Well, they had just passed that fig tree, no doubt. There's no question in my mind they just passed it. And so when he says the fig tree, they know specifically which fig tree that he's talking about. Well, 21, there is no real question that the single fig tree mentioned earlier in Mark is still the subject of the lesson Jesus is trying to impart. The bigger theological question is how one is to identify the fig tree. Well, 22, however, in terms of exegetical and theological consistency, there is no reason to identify this fig tree in any other way than what it had been previously identified in chapter 11. In fact, to identify it another way than chapter 11 is to take the context of Mark and just shred it. And just say, well, I can make it anything I want because context means nothing. Well, I thought this was how we interpreted books, was in context. I thought context meant everything. And that's another lesson you get pounded into your head first year seminary in Greek. Context, context, context. You've got to know context. Well, theologically and exegetically, you can't make this anything different than what it already was. I mean, you can, people have, but there's no real legitimate scholarly reason to do so. And in fact, it betrays sort of a willingness to just ad lib in this passage, because the passage in Mark is clear. So in the context of Mark 11, sandwiched as it was between the events in the temple, there is no real question that the fig tree was a figure for the temple. Its corrupt leadership and the fact that the temple system was not producing fruit and was about to be judged by God. And 24, in fact, the temple under Jewish unbelief had not been bearing the fruit God sought for some time and will never bear the fruit God seeks again until the kingdom of Messiah is established. Luke 13, 6 and 7. Here's another one in which I would say, and now in terms of parabolic interpretation, I would still say in terms of consistency, the fig tree represents the temple and the vineyard would represent national Israel. The fig tree being the smaller item within the confines of the larger nation. And he began telling this parable. A man had a fig tree which had been planted in his vineyard. And he came looking for fruit on it and did not find any. Now, I've got plenty of exegetical proof that the vineyard in the Old Testament refers to national Israel. But if the vineyard refers to national Israel, then what's the fig tree refer to? Well, again, if I hadn't have done Mark, I probably wouldn't know. But doing Mark unlocked all this. It refers to the temple system. And he said to the vineyard keeper, behold, for 3 years I have come looking for fruit on this fig tree without finding any. Cut it down. Why does it even use up the ground? And he said, well, let's give it a period of probation. Don't freak out and start cutting trees down. Let's give this tree another year and I'll work on it and dig around it. And if it bears fruit next year, fine. If not, cut it down. And this was a fact that the entire system had been on probation during the first advent. As the Lord was looking for this divine good production, all the stuff that they're supposed to be producing and they're not. Because as we know, all of this comes, divine good production, everything we shoot for has to come of your own volition. It can't be external, it can't be coerced. We're not here to try to browbeat you into applying. We're here to give you the information so you can take it and run and make the applications that you need to make in your particular niche. But we're not here to coerce you, we exhort, we encourage, I'll provide all the information, but ultimately it has to be you that does it. Just as it had to be these Jews that did it, and they didn't. They weren't producing the fruit, and they weren't going to. And Jesus knew it. Well, 25, Jesus directly identifies this as a parable, which confirms about the previous interpretation about the cursing of the fig tree as being an acted out parable. And that very much fits the bill for what we had in the fig tree. Why was he was using this physical symbol to show them that the temple, the entire temple system was corrupt and it was under judgment. It looked good on the surface, just as that fig tree looked like it should have some fruit on it. And some have argued, well, you know, John or Luke, one of them says that it's not the season for figs. And so some people have Jesus acting like a petulant child. Oh, I wanted figs and couldn't get any, so I cursed the fig tree. That's not the Lord. No. That's not how he handles things. And so they don't want to, they just have him being crazy here. Like Jesus didn't know when there would be figs on those trees. Like he was a complete idiot at 35 years old and didn't have any clue about fruit or how it worked. Are you kidding me? There should have been, as we pointed out, some small, edible, not great, but small edible figs should have been on that tree. The tree and leaf portended that there would be some fruit there, but there wasn't. Just as that entire temple system with all its sacrifices and ritual and all of that said, hey, these are the people that are serving and worshiping God. They weren't. That's just a big show. Just a big leafy tree that doesn't really produce what God's looking for. Well, he identifies this as a parable, which fits very well, again, with the fact that the cursing of the fig tree was an acted out parable designed to show you the connection between that and the temple. And 26, that is seen in the figure of the branch becoming tender and putting forth its leaves, which now views the fig tree as viable and functional once again. Well, 27, the use of the normal course of events is common to parabolic teaching. In this case, the warming days of spring cause the sap to begin to flow again, and buds begin to appear on the tree. Well, if the fig tree, point 28, referred to the fruitless temple worship of Israel in Mark 11, it makes sense in terms of exegetical logic and consistency to recognize that a similar subject is still in view here. But now we haven't had a temple since 70 AD, and in fact, guess what? We still don't have one. So, if this is a sign, if this temple, the rebuilding of the temple is the sign, we've been looking for the wrong thing. That's the sad reality. We have been looking for the wrong thing by identifying this as national Israel. And for the church age believer, bear in mind that all this information Jesus is giving in Mark 13 is all confined to what? Daniel 70th week. It's not about the church age at all. He skips over the entire church age. He doesn't even reference it. Other than just in broad strokes where he says, oh, these kinds of things are going to happen. But he doesn't specifically identify it to, say, the church age, that dispensation. He just, you know, uses these broad strokes to say wars, rumors of wars, famines, earthquakes, etc., etc. But nothing specifically germane to the church age, you know, as it were, as opposed to, say, the age of Israel. Because let's face it, some of those things, you know, went on. There were wars and rumors of wars in the age of Israel. It's not like they're unique to the church age. And he tells them, of course, these aren't things to be looked at, even that. And in terms of the end, these are not your signs. Well, 29, this understanding, based on overall context, and not isolating on verses 28 through 30 alone, would suggest that following the destruction of the temple, as seen in the cursing of the fig tree, there would come a time when the temple would resume its function. 30 again, if the fig tree represented the temple and its fruitless worship, with the leaves representing the unbelieving leadership, there is no legitimate reason to identify this parabolic teaching in any other way in this chapter. Again, if you're careful with the Bible, much of it interprets itself. You don't have to be some sort of guy who goes out and ad-libs every interpretation. The Bible will deal with itself if you give it a chance. So, 31, while there is an ongoing effort to rebuild the temple and reestablish the worship of Yahweh in Israel, the branch being tender and the leaves being present point to a functioning temple and not merely the plan for one. And 32, thus for all the prophetic noise that is made about Israel, Jerusalem, and the temple, until church age believers observe it up and functioning, There are only general signs about the second advent, which must be taken as a package, that you have these sort of general conditions that we know are going to exist as we move into the last days. And we know that those conditions do exist. I mean, we've got prophecies that point to us, the general evil and the degradation of mankind that's going on, that continues to deteriorate. We see this, the world going down this cesspool, and there it goes. And it continues to intensify. Rejection of doctrine is rampant. It's an all-time high. So, as is evident here, point in our verse, point 33, there is a mention of sap flowing and leaves coming forth, but again, no mention of any fruit on the tree. But you wouldn't expect fruit at this time in the process. In a normal fig tree or any other tree, when they begin to blossom and put out their leaves and all that, you're not expecting fruit the next day. That is not a sign of anything other than fruit may be coming down the road. And even that, as we know, is not a sign that fruit's coming down the road. Because you can have a tree that looks healthy, blossoms, has lots of leaves on it, and has no fruit. But otherwise, it appears healthy. But there's something wrong with it. But whatever it is. Well, 34, even when the temple is rebuilt, whether that occurs before or after the rapture. Now, here gets a theological question that I don't think anybody's effectively addressed yet. And my suspicion is that the temple won't be built till after the rapture. That they're going to throw this thing up quick. But of course, they've already got everything prepared and everything's planned and it's all laid out. It's just a matter of the timing of the deal. But if they start building that temple before the rapture, come on by, we'll start drinking my wine up because I don't want to leave it here. I got priorities, man. You think, oh, you'll want to run around and evangelize the world. No. Well, take a credit card out and have some fun. Well, you can see why maybe if this is the sign that God wouldn't give it before the end of the church age. Because it might wreck some of us. You know, some of the lesser of us like me that would, you know, fall into that stuff. Well, whether the temple is rebuilt, that temple system will not produce the divine good that God seeks. Once again, it's going to be a failure. But will rather become the place of the Antichrist, fulfilling the prophecy of Jesus. The prophecy of Jesus, let's hit John 5:43 first, because that's where the actual prophecy is. The fulfillment of it is seen in 2 Thessalonians. And this is a bit of a vague prophecy, I get. Some people may read it and not figure out what he's saying here. But I think it's pretty straightforward to those of us who understand. I have come in my Father's name, and you do not receive me. But if another comes in his own name, you will receive him. And it's a direct reference to Antichrist. That they will accept him. They will have no problem endorsing him and embracing him. They'll love him. This is a sad commentary on the negative volition of the Jews, but it's true. 2 Thessalonians 2:4. Here the Antichrist who opposes and exalts himself above every so-called God or object of worship. In other words, he's not going to talk again. We pointed out Antichrist is not this sort of modern ecumenical figure who's going to just endorse and embrace everybody. He takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. And so he's going to claim divinity. There's just no question about it. But he's conquered death, so he's got good reasons for this. And the world has good reason to believe him, because he's come back from the dead and they can prove all this. Well, 35, thus the correct interpretation of this passage is not found in identifying the fig tree as the nation of Israel in general, which has been the modern traditional view, or even identifying it as Jerusalem specifically. I've seen some people that take this. They apparently were at least, in one sense, at least one guy I read, he was uncomfortable with the identification of the fig tree as national Israel, but he didn't know what to do with it. He recognized that wasn't probably it, but he didn't know what to do with it, so he assigned it to Jerusalem specifically and said, Jerusalem is the fig tree. Well, this gives him, again, now this lets him, if that is, quote, the sign, then, quote, the clock didn't begin ticking until 1967. But, however, We're already 45 years away from that. We're pushing the very end of that generation, if it was Jerusalem. But I think, again, overall context of Mark, you can't argue for anything but the temple. That's the real deal here, is that you can't just plug Jerusalem into this. Jerusalem has not been mentioned, in fact, hardly in any of this, the city itself. Well, 36, although there are Old Testament passages that could be cited to support either of these identifications, and many have cited them, those are certainly found in much more remote context than Mark 13 is found from the context of Mark 11. Now, that is near context. Now, I can go look at these verses, and we'll look at them, Jeremiah 8:3, because I think, number one, if you haven't heard these verses used, then you probably will at some point. Where are we at here? Jeremiah 8:13. I will surely snatch them away, declares the Lord. There will be no grapes on the vine and no figs on the fig tree, and the leaf will wither, and what I have given them will pass away. Okay? Well, when you look in the context here, he's talking about Israel, of course. He's talking about his people and the Jews and how they are not living up to the terms of the covenant, which they never did or will. I will snatch them away. This has been said, okay, well then, I will snatch them away refers to dispersion. No problem with that. Don't have any trouble with that. He's going to take them out of the land. There will be no grapes on the vine and no figs on the fig tree. Well, then you have to get into, well, what's the vine and what's the fig tree, if you're going to interpret this? And in most cases, they have just said the vine and the fig tree are the same thing. Well, I know the difference between a grapevine and a fig tree. I know they're not the same thing, in fact. And so then that becomes that question. You've got to identify this. And this verse has been taken, just plucked out of its context and said, this is national Israel. Okay, fine, I get that. Jeremiah 24:1 and following. And this gets into another deal, but this is actually about figs and not about fig trees. You say, well, what's the difference? Well, there's a big difference. Figs are the fruit. Fig trees are what produces them. So here he talks about this. He showed me two baskets of figs in verse 1 set before the temple. One basket had very good figs, like first ripe figs, and the other basket had very bad figs, which could not be eaten due to rottenness. And the Lord said, what do you see, Jeremiah? And he said, I see figs. The good figs, very good. The bad figs, very bad. And the word of the Lord says, thus says the Lord God of Israel, verse 5, like these good figs, so I will regard as good the captives of Judah whom I have sent out of this place. And so if one wants to make figs, all Jews, well, they're not all Jews. There's a distinction here between good figs and bad figs even. That the captives of Judah who oriented to the Babylonian captivity were going to be blessed by God. Those that rebelled against it were going to be cursed by God. All the Jews weren't the same figs. They were good figs and bad figs. So if one wants to make this the nation, and then, of course, then the figs are the people, that at least you have some basis for in this passage. Now, I don't think that's, again, what's happening here totally. But you do see here the people likened to figs, but not likened to fig trees. The nation is nowhere in this, does it say anywhere that Jerusalem is the fig tree. Now, the passage that's most often cited, Joel 1:7, is a problematic passage in its own right. Because this is cited as the definitive passage. So of all the doctrines of the fig tree, if you go look at them, you'll see this passage plays a prominent role in the documentation. Joel 1:7, when he talks about this invasion that's going to come, about the locusts, the swarming locust comes, the creeping locust, the stripping locust, and all of this, for a nation has invaded my land, verse 6, mighty and without number. Its teeth are the teeth of a lion, and it has the fangs of a lioness. It has made my vine a waste and my fig tree splinters. It has stripped them bare and cast them away. Their branches have become white. And so here, because you're talking about national invasion, on an international level, you're talking about another nation invading Israel, then the vine and the fig tree must be referring to national Israel. That's the context in which this verse is used. Now, a couple of problems with this. Number one, this appears to be a millennial prophecy, or certainly a Daniel 70th week prophecy. Joel, as far as we know, this passage has not been fulfilled. This was not a prophecy about the dispersion of the nation in 70 AD. It was not a prophecy about that. And it's pretty clear if you go and look, and you know, if you want to do the work and want to read a lot of boring stuff, you'll find out that most interpreters have admitted that this is probably still future, that this hasn't happened. Well, if this hasn't happened, how can this, if this is referring to a future event, then how can this refer to national Israel and its dispersion? Because context here doesn't say that's what it refers to exactly. It's just talking about this invasion. Well, additionally, those verses may be understood literally and not taken as figures for Israel, Jerusalem, or the temple. You look in there, when he talks about a nation that comes in mighty without number, teeth the teeth of a lion and the fangs of a lioness, you almost, from the analogy here, get the idea that these wild beasts are destroying his vine and his fig tree. And it stripped them bare and cast them away, that as a part of national invasion, what if this is just literal here in Joel 1:7? What if they just come in and they just destroy the economy as nations, invading nations often did? They didn't come in and just take over in some cases. They would burn and slash and destroy everything in their path. So what if this is literal here? Well, if one can even make the argument that this might be literal, well, then it you can't prove that it's figurative, is the whole issue. And I think at least in this passage, the question is begged, is this just a literal deal of what they're going to come in? They're going to come in and they're going to trash the place, essentially. Well, 38, thus the accepted interpretations of this sign have been incorrect. And this very likely accounts for the continual need to change the identification of the fig tree, or more importantly, to change the dates involved in the prophecy. Many, including this interpreter, have identified national Israel as the fig tree, and the reestablishment of the nation in 1948 as the time it began to put forth leaves. However, given that a generation is viewed as about 40 years in the Bible, this means that the Second Advent would have occurred at sometime around 1988, which it clearly did not. And I remember going through all of this back at that time. I was a fundy still. I was in the Southern Baptist. And I remember all of this and thinking, yeah, if this is all correct, we're going to be raptured here pretty quick. We thought it had to be 1981, so we got psyched. And then we thought, well, maybe it's the whole 40-year period. So then we thought it was 1988. Then we got psyched. And then we said, well, maybe it's not that. Maybe it's Jerusalem when they became the capital in 67. And then we went 40 years from that and said, well, then the rapture's in 2007. Well, it wasn't. And we keep missing it. Why? Because the problem, I think, is our beginning dates is wrong. That's why we keep missing it on the backside. Because we've identified this wrongly, and so therefore the dates never work. Well, thus, point C, some have opted for a generation of 70 years based on Psalm 90:10. But that simply places the Second Advent some 30 years later in 2018. Well, then that means the rapture occurred in 2011. Well, it didn't. The numbers still don't fit. Even if you start expanding them out, they still don't fit. Well, D, this is an example of the mental gymnastics that become necessary to support the identification of Israel as the fig tree. Psalm 90 does not speak about a generation. It speaks about the normal lifespan of humans. And this was written, Psalm 90, by the way, is a psalm that was written by Moses. And so we're talking about 1450 BC or approximately. And Moses said in 1450 BC, the average life expectancy was about 70 years. Well, guess what? You go look now, it hasn't changed very much. Now, because of technology and all, and the fact that we can keep people alive on breathing tubes and feeding tubes, I'm not sure that constitutes much of a life. We might have it up to 72 years. I think women live slightly longer than men, but that doesn't surprise me. Because they have it so much easier, right? No, but I think women live like a year or something longer, maybe. But it's still only about 70 years is the deal. So Psalm 90:10, as for the days of our life, they contain 70 years. Or if due to strength, 80 years. But their pride is but labor and sorrow, for soon it is gone and we fly away. But that is a lifespan. That's not a generation, that's a lifespan. And those two are not the same things either. Well, however, given the fact that the second advent comes some 7 years after the rapture of the church, this places the rapture in 2011, which obviously did not occur. And if some seek to identify the fig tree as Jerusalem, since Jerusalem was once again made the official capital in 1967, now my question is, if whoever said Jerusalem had to be the capital for all these things to be fulfilled? What if Tel Aviv had remained the capital of Israel? Would that violate any of the prophecies? Not that I know of. I don't think it matters what city is the capital in Israel at that level. I mean, we have a sense it's always going to be Jerusalem. But I mean, there were times where Jerusalem wasn't the capital. I mean, it's like in Oklahoma in the early days, Guthrie was the capital. Well, they moved to capital. Well, does it matter if you were going to be in the land run, did you care where the capital was? No, not really. Well, however, even if you do that, 40 years from that date places the second advent in 2007, with the rapture occurring in 2000, again, which it did not. So one of the problems with these numbers is they keep not working. And I've known, I mean, that's been something that's troubled me in the back of my mind for a while, I have to be honest. I mean, I would look at certain things and I would think, you know, this doesn't quite fit, but I don't know what's wrong with it. I didn't really, I mean, at the time, you just don't know, so you can't comment. All right, well, our time is gone. We'll stop there. Actually, we're a little over today. But we'll be picking up here on Tuesday and continuing to plow through this. And you will need, after this next exposition, the doctrine, the revised doctrine of the fig tree, which you all should have. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your plan. May God, the Holy Spirit, sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.